So, we are in the fourth chapter of Shoftim. Perek Dalet, Pasuk Dalet, chapter 4, sentence 4. And you'll recall that last time we talked about the Knanim and introduced the problem that the Jews have. They have sinned. Ehud is now dead. Shamgar, we're not entirely sure about his role in this. Is he when the Knanim are already in control? But either way, we end up under the control of Yavin, who had reigned in the city of Chatzor. His general is Sisra. We talked about, is this the same Yavin as in Yoshua? Is it a different Yavin? Okay. His capital is the city of Haroshet HaGoyim. He has 900 chariots. He controls us for 20 years. And we cry out to God. So now we get to finally meet Devorah. U'Devorah isha nevi'ah, eshes lapidos. He shoftas Yisrael ba'isahi. The Devorah is a prophetess. She is an eshet lapidot. For anyone here have a translation? I'm curious to see what they do for eshet lapidot.
Wife of lapidot.
Wife of lapidot. Okay, well that's one way to translate it. So a lapid is actually a torch, as opposed to just a candle. But the
wife, like this kind of a torch.
Yeah, kind of like a cone shape, you know, that sort of thing. So Devorah is described as Eshet Lapidot. We need to know what in the world that means. He shoftad Yisrael beitahi, and she judged Israel at that time. We already talked about the question of her functioning as a judge. V'hi yosheves tachas tomer Devorah, and she sits beneath a palm tree that is known as the date palm of Devorah. That's her tree. Bein harama uvein beis el bahar Ephraim, between Rama and Beit El, so we have some sense of where this is, on Har Ephraim, where everything happens. V'ya'alu elah b'nei Yisrael ha'mishpat, and the Jews used to go to her anytime they needed a case heard, they would go to her to judge. That's our introduction to Devorah. So first of all, I brought you on the sheet just because you really got to see it. Source number one, the list of the women who are identified as the Nevi'ot of Tanakh. So Sheva Nevi'ot, Maninu, who are the seven prophetesses? Sarah, Miriam, Devorah, Chana, Abigail, Huldah, and Esther. That's your list. These are not the only women in Tanakh to experience, you know, conversation with God or conversation with a Navi, with a Malach, I should say. But these are the seven who are recorded here as the Nevi'ot, the prophetesses. And then the Gemara goes on to ask, how do we know they were prophetesses? Where did they prophesy? Some of them are more clear and explicit. Devorah, for example. Huldah is another example. In other cases, it's a matter of the Gemara looking at something they said and saying, oh, well, that was prophetic. And therefore, we know that she is a prophetess. Ah, so Huldah is one of the best. Huldah is a prophetess in the time of King Yoshiyahu, which is why people haven't heard of her, because people don't usually read that part of Tanakh. But she is the one who, when they're refurbishing the Beis HaMikdash and they discover a mysterious scroll which frightens everybody, she's the one who explains what it is and what its significance is. She's the one that they go to. She's in the time of Yirmiyahu. So that's Huldah. But yes, on the list, she's definitely the least known out of all of them, with Abigail being second on the list. Well, she ends up being David HaMelech's wife. She's not originally, but that's another story. So that's your list, and Devorah's on the list. So she is herself. She is a Nevi'ah. She is Eshet Lapidot. So this is a real problem. Logically, when you see someone described as Eshet Lapidot, what do you assume that means? Yeah, right? That's one possible assumption, is her husband's name is Lapidot. You wouldn't necessarily, but I guess you could say, Ruth suggests it's geographic. You know, so we have people identified as being from somewhere, but usually it doesn't come in the form of Ish something or Eshet something. So, but yes, it's hypothetically possible. It could be a place. What's the other, Ruth, you were going to say?
Oh, no. I said
it's
like a title.
A title.
Lapid is a stone, right?
No, lapid is a torch.
Oh. So it's a place such as a torch.
Right. So if it's like so, one of the worlds is that.
Torch
that didn't help me.
She sells torches. She makes torches.
We always think that she makes candles or wicks.
Yeah,
that's
what
our
family.
Yeah.
When
okay.
You go to Deborah.
So fundamentally, all of these are problematic. Meaning, if it's about her, it's a description of her. I don't know what it means to be a person of Lapidot. If it's about her husband. We have a problem because we don't know anybody in Tanakh named Lapidot that you would just say, oh, her? Yeah, she's the wife of Lapidot.
I wasn't
saying
somebody.
Could it be something like the firebrand?
No, so sure. That's a possibility. So
we don't have Sarah Eshet Abraham, do we?
I mean, yeah, we do. Sarai is usually in her earliest. She's known as Sarai Eshet Abraham. Yeah, it actually comes up as a specific message that she is Sarai Eshet Abraham.
Yeah, here the rest is a woman who makes.
Oh, don't. That's my job. So, three different approaches. The first approach I'll bring you is brought by Radak and Ralbag. And that is the approach that she is married to somebody who's named Lapidot. Ah, but I don't know who Lapidot is. Yes, you do. Take a look at source number two. Radak says, Amru, they say, Shehu Barak ben Avi Noam, that this is Barak, who is going to ultimately lead the Jews in war. Now, you'll tell me, then why didn't you say Eshet Barak? Ubarak v'Lapidot krovim be'inyan. Barak and Lapidot are similar words, because Barak means lightning, and Lapidot means torches, so they're both names associated with fire, and therefore Eshet Lapidot. I find that difficult. In the sense that... It's not as though you didn't know his name was Barak, because he's going to show up in the next pasuk by the name of Barak. So it's not like, in some places we call him Barak, and in some places we call him Lapidot. It's right here. So that's a very strange thing.
Why isn't he with her if they're married?
Well, that's actually the next question is, if so, then why do you need to send, as she's going through in Pasuk Vav, she's going to send for Barak, and that's actually going to lead to an idea that we'll see it. I brought it here, actually, in number three. Well, take a look at number three. Vatishlach, Radak says, she sent for Barak. Im haisa ishto, if she was his wife, then haisa prusha me'ez his nav usa. She had separated from him since the start of her prophecy, right? Remember, who does this remind you of?
Moshe,
right? The whole idea of Moshe separating from Tzipporah. How do we know that Moshe separated from Tzipporah?
She came.
Right. Because it's talking about Yisro bringing her after he had sent her. That's the idea that he has separated from her. It comes up at the end of this week's parasha, at the end of Baloscha, because we understand that that fits into it, because it says that Miriam gets in trouble because she has been talking to Aaron about this woman, the Cushite woman, he had taken. So the big question that's asked, one big question is, who is the Isha Cushite? Tzipporah is from Midian, she's not a Cushite. And then the other question that comes up is, what do you mean, who he had taken? So they give the answer that he had married her and then he had separated from her, and that's what Miriam is talking about, is the fact that Moshe had married her and then separated from her. But that's where this idea comes from.
That doesn't explain why they call her
Kushit. No, it doesn't explain Kushit at all. That's a whole other discussion of what the message is in calling Tzipporah Kushit. If you want, at the end, we can go through that. It's the parsha. But the statement that Moshe separates because he's going to talk to God is also associated with the Jews at Har Sinai, where we're told for 3 days before they receive the Torah, or maybe 2 days before they receive the Torah, and then on the third day, we did that in the pre-Shavuos class, the Jews are told that the husbands and wives have to separate. So she is not just somebody who prophesied once, she is a regular prophetess, and therefore she's separated from her husband, and v'yashva l'tachas ha-tomer, she sits beneath this date palm, v'yata shalcha likro lo, le'mor lo, ha-nevua, sher diber Hashem. So now she sends for him in order to tell him the prophecy that God had given her. So that's one possibility. A second possibility is simply this was her job during the day. She's sitting under Tomer Devara. She lives in Kedesh Naphtali, which is where we're going to see Barak is, but she's in Tomer Devara. She has a prophecy for him, and so she sends for him. She's not waiting till tonight to go home and tell him about it. There are two weaknesses with this approach, that she's married to Barak, and Barak equals Lapidot. Number one is, you could have just called him Barak, And number two, in the next pasuk, in pasuk Vav, we're going to get a full introduction to him. She sends and she calls to Barak ben Avinoam from Kedesh Naphtali. Here we're talking about him as though we know him. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, she's the wife of Lapidot. Like, if it's really the same person as Barak, then why does he get a full introduction? He should have done the introduction here. So that's a weakness with this. The second approach is the Gemara in Megillah, which is the one from the Bamitzvah program. And that's source number four. My Eshet Lapidot. What does it mean when you say that she is woman of Lapidot? Shaisa Osa Psilos Lamikdash. She made wicks for use in the Beis HaMikdash. So a Lapid being a torch, so therefore she was making those.
They gave her a women's job.
Well, like, Aisha could be like the Mrs., right? She was Mrs. Candlemaker. Like, she was Mrs. Whitman.
Well, that actually isn't so difficult, because we find that frequently in the Torah that the word Ish or Isha is used regarding the trade that someone practices. Yeah. A warrior is an Ish Milchama, as an example. So, you know, that works, right? Well, Isha isn't about what she does.
And it seems very logical that that explanation works.
Yeah, the only problem is that the word lapid is a very strange word for the wick used in a menorah or in a it's not the normal word that you would use. It's still awkward. The third possibility, and it's an entirely different approach, is that this is a statement about her identity, and this goes back to the firebrand suggestion. Where was the firebrand?
Ruth.
Okay, Ruth, you got it. Okay. The firebrand suggestion. Abarbanel adopts this view. Mitzvah David adopts this view. Take a look at source number 5. Bamesha Amar Akasav Isha Nevi'ah. He said, the text already calls her prophetess. Hora Shlemus Sichla V'tov HaChanasa. That already demonstrates the perfection of her intellect, her readiness for prophecy. Adshaya Nilva Eileha HaRuach HaNevu'i, to such a point that she experiences prophecy. Ubamesha Amar Eshet Lapidot, and as far as Eshet Lapidot, Hora Shahaisa Eshes Chayil. That shows that she is a mighty woman. That's the best translation I can give you for Eshet Chayil. There are too many other possibilities. The only thing we do know is that it does not mean woman of valor. Her deeds were very strong, very energetic. She was like this lapid esh, the fiery torch. Eshet lapidot, she is a fiery person, which is going to fit very well with her message, because you're going to see in her message a certain harshness, a certain toughness, and a level of kind of an acid wit, if you will, in terms of the way that she deals with Barak first, and then in the way that she deals with the rest of the Jewish people as well. She's a very sharp person.
She wouldn't have been what she was if she hadn't been. Yeah.
Right, but it's going to cause problems, as you'll see. There's even the possibility that's suggested that, you know, how Moshe comes back from Har Sinai, and he has to cover his face because of the prophecy that he had with God, and he's radiant now. So the suggestion is maybe that was also that she had that radiance as a result of her prophecy, and that's the Eshet Lapidot image. Depending on which one of these you choose, that tells you something about the latter two, really, more. Tell you something about her. The first one, being married to Barak, doesn't really say anything. Okay, so if he's married to Barak, fine. But if you take the view that it's about making wicks for the Beis HaMikdash, it's talking about Kedusha, it's talking about holiness. If you take the view that it's about her fiery identity, you know, her personality, so it's telling you that this is a very fiery person, this is a dangerous person, this isn't somebody you necessarily, you know, want to start off with. Yeah.
It's not to say that she didn't have spare time, but the whole, she made wicks for the temple. If she is judging the people constantly or whatever, you would think that would be a very, very busy job. That she wouldn't be sitting, I don't know.
In Allentown, there was a woman who used to come to my class and crochet.
Crochet, right.
Yeah, she used to come and crochet. She asked permission first. But
I think she judged while making wicks.
It's an interesting idea. It's an interesting question. I don't have anything to really, you know, do with it. I would note, though, that making wicks for the Beis HaMikdash is not something to be looked down on. In the Gemara notes that they made the wicks for the menorah out of the worn-out clothing of the Kohanim. the because the Kohanim were not allowed to wear anything that was patched or fixed up. Like it had to be the most beautiful of beautiful, most perfect of perfect. So once, you know, it got stained or torn or whatever it was, that's what you would then use to make the wicks for the menorah. Well, if you look at right, if you look at the colors though, they had very strong colors. It could be that, you know, light things would just sort of fade into the fabric. That's Yom Kippur. That's the Beit Levana of Yom Kippur. So if you look at the description, it's very colored. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, but if they're slaughtering animals for sacrifice, they get blood splashed. Maybe they weren't grease or whatever.
They didn't have rubber.
Yeah. So she's the Eshel Lapidot, and she judges beneath, or she sits beneath, the palm tree of Devorah. So the literal read of it is that she had a house, and there was a big palm tree, and everybody knew that's the palm tree of Devorah. However, the Gemara offers us two other explanations that are fascinating. Source number 6. Maishna Tachas Tomer. The Gemara wants to know, why did you take the time to specify that she's beneath the palm of Devorah? Like, what does that add to our story? So, Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Avshalom Mishum Yichud. Rabbi Shimon ben Avshalom says, because you have a problem of seclusion. Meaning, she is in this leadership capacity. People come to her with their problems. They're going to talk to her. You know, if she's in a house somewhere, in a building somewhere, they could potentially be alone with her, which halachically is very problematic. Not to mention, is a bad idea in general. But but from a halachic position, you can't do that. So therefore, what it's doing is it's trying to tell us she sat outside. She's under the tree, out in the open, and there should be no problems. Dabar acher, alternatively, it's actually meant to convey a message. Matamar ze ein lo ela lev echad. A date palm has only one heart. What do you think that means?
Hearts of palm.
Hearts of palm. But what does it mean? What's the?
One center. They all stem from one
center.
Yeah.
Right. Palm trees are not like, you know, your standard trees where they branch out. Right. The palm tree is just the one. It's the one trunk all the way up. So the so just like that has that one heart, that's it. It's a unified thing. So too, the Jews of that time, unlike the rest of Sefer Shoftim, have one heart for God, and that's it. They become loyal to God under her leadership. So that's the other possibility. Okay. Getting there.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's fine. That's fine. It's fine, and you could have read Rashi. No. So that brings us to the palm tree of Devorah, which is very strange, because the psukim sound like you should know the place. So one possibility is that it's the symbolic thing, Tomer Devorah, like we've already, you know, talked about as a rule. And Ralbach says it's known as the place you go to find Devorah. This is where she judges. However, there is Abarbanel quotes a medrash, which I couldn't find the medrash itself, but Abarbanel quotes this this idea that yes, this is associated with the tree beneath which Rivka's Devorah was buried. Meaning, it's back in the 35th chapter in Bereshis, where Vatamas Sham Devorah Meinekes Rivka. Devorah, the nursemaid of Rivka, dies, and she's buried Tachat Ha'alon, underneath an alon. Now, an alon, we think we usually assume is an oak tree, not a date palm. But that's the suggestion, anyway, of this medrash, that that tree was the tree of Devorah. And that's what we're now... Well, she passed away ages ago. We have, not palm tree of this Devorah. In other words, that Devorah died. You know, it's just, there's a Devorah who's buried beneath a tree, and here's a tree that's identified with a Devorah. So, hey, maybe it's the same tree.
What if a Kohen needs to be judged? You have a dead body over it.
Well, it's been a few centuries. It could be that the body deteriorated by then. I don't know.
Is that Jeffrey?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So how does it go from the oak tree to the palm tree?
Yeah, that's the other problem. It's
a totally different location.
But that's the other problem. Is that the right place? It's actually not. There's a Beit El association there also. But to give me something with Beit El Tachat Ha'alon.
But she was located, didn't we say, somewhere up
between Ramah and Beit El.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, the Beit Hillel Association works.
Didn't she last week that she was, who was, I listened to your recording.
Yeah.
Somewhere near Afula, north, who was
that's where the Canaanim are in control.
Oh.
Yeah, that's
sorry.
Where the Canaanim are in control. No, you're remembering. So, yes, the Beit Hillel Association also helps, although we don't actually know that she was there. This is the strangest part of this story and this description. We read that it sounded like, between Beit El, between Ramah and Beit El on Har Ephraim. It really couldn't be any simpler in terms of the identification, right? We're given places that we know of. And yet, Targum Yonatan, which is a very important Aramaic explanation of Navi, of the prophets, for some reason, and I can't figure out why, says she was wealthy, and she actually was not between Ramah and Beit El. She was in a place called Atarot. It mentions these because these were the places where her wealth was. She had whatever she had, you know, whatever business it was in Ramah, was in Beit El, and that's how she got her money. And she's actually staying in Atarot, and I can't figure it out at all. Why Atarot? Well, that's the thing. There are various places. Atarot is one of those common words, so much so that sometimes it's Atarot Shofan or Atarot this or Atarot that. And I went looking for Atarots that we find in Israel, and I found on the eastern side of the Yarden is the most famous one. The eastern side of the Yarden is one of the cities that they mention, the 2.5 tribes, when they want to get land on the east of the Yarden. So they say, Atarot v'divon v'azer v'nera. But it can't be that she's sitting and judging east of the Yarden. That makes no sense.
No, but nowadays there's an Atarot. Could it be the same area where...
It was a common enough name that, you know, anything is possible, but I don't know how you would know. But I went looking around, like I did searches for like Atarot with Devorah, you know, to see if there's anything in Tanakh that lends itself to this. I can't find an Atarot in Naphtali, which is where logically you'd think she would be, especially if she's married to Barak. So I don't know what to do with it, but Targum Yonatan says it, and Rashi quotes it, you have to take it seriously. So there is that possibility that she's not actually between Ramah and Beit El and not on Har Ephraim. Go figure.
Where would they store the rejected cloths for the wicks?
They had a storage area in the Beis HaMikdash.
Yeah. That has nothing to do then with the Asherah.
Not that I know of. A little storage area. That would be interesting, but no, not that I... Nah.
But Asherah means...
Crowns.
Pen?
Crowns.
Yeah, it's... So maybe it's got some association with what it means, not necessarily a particular place.
Don't know. Linda,
what?
Where is Tamir Devorah? Well, if we're accepting this, between Ramah and Beit El on Har Ephraim. Har Ephraim is this big centrally located mountain. It's where many of the events in Sefer Shoftim take place.
So there's an airport. North of Jerusalem,
isn't it?
That's
where yes.
I'm talking
about.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if she lived near the airport. I mean, it'd be convenient. She has a court there.
Yeah.
You know. We'll fly in. Don't know. One other note on this. We're getting a picture of Devorah here, but one piece that you sort of have to bring in, even though it's inviting trouble to mention it, but... Sorry, I may cut this off of the audio. So. If you take a look at number seven, the Gemara talks about Devorah and makes a play on her name. What is a Devorah? A bee, right? Bee. Well, it's a stinging insect, is what it comes down to. So the Gemara uses the Aramaic term for Devorah, which is Ziburta. It's the same word. The Dalet and the Zayin often switch between Hebrew and Aramaic. So Ziburta is Devorta, Devorah. And it says regarding her as the wasp. Ziburta is a term for a wasp. So regarding this stinging insect, Ksiv ba, batishlach batikrole barak. She sent for Barak, which we don't know yet because it's going to be in Pasuk Vav, but we'll see it there. She sent for Barak. The ilu ihi lo azal legabe, she didn't go to him. Now, in context, I didn't bring you the full context, but in context in this Gemara, what it says is that she had a level of yuhara about her. Yuhara is an Aramaic word, which generally is associated with a level of self-righteousness and a level of arrogance. The Gemara talks about people who take on extra stringencies in a way that others are going to see, specifically in front of the public. So a person who bows very low for Shemona Esrei, that kind of thing, and it condemns it as yuhara, that it's considered to be something that is arrogant and inappropriate. And what the Gemara here is doing is accusing her of arrogance because she summons Barak instead of going to him, and the Gemara is very uncomfortable with that, and that's why it calls her Ziburta, you know, which is a little bit of a more degrading thing to say. So inevitably,
to do with the personality of a female loss, does that have anything to do with that?
Well, only in the sense that it stings.
Yeah. Well, if she was this, I mean, from what they said before, she was a very strong character, and so she was.
I just want to know if it connected at all to characteristics of the female. Yeah.
I don't know if it means subservient, per se.
Okay, maybe not that word, but you know, like a leader as a woman. Staying home with the kids, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of it I think you have to view in terms of
I think that's what they're saying, is that she wasn't like the typical woman of the time.
But I don't think that this isn't binary. This doesn't have to be like either you are, you know, summoning the head of the army to come to you or subservient. There's a whole range in the middle.
Right.
Yeah, true.
I mean, she is being criticized, but and the Gemara does identify it as specifically that she is a woman. It comes up in it, but it's not just because of this. If you jump ahead a little bit to I don't want to go to Parak Hei Pasuk Zayin, chapter 5, sentence 7. But I'm going to get there. I'm going to get to this. I want to address the gender point, but I wanted to show you something else first. Yeah.
So there, like you said, there's a range of women have probably whatever they were doing. She was a manager, maybe making
right. Whatever that. Yeah.
And other roles.
Yeah.
Making wool or all kinds
of things.
So separate and
right.
Yeah,
it doesn't.
Playing wars. But
right. Well, that's what we're going to see also.
But she was calling him in her position as a judge.
Judge or prophetess, really.
Prophetess. So you right. think that gives her a little bit of leeway to be a little more demanding.
So I'm going to come back to that. It's a good point. Just hold the thought for a minute. Take a look first at chapter 5, sentence 7, Perek Hei Pasuk Zayin, where this is part of her song, and she says, Chadlu Prazon B'Yisrael. There were no more open cities in Israel. Everybody had to live in fortresses because they were afraid of the Canaanim. Ad Shakamti Devorah, until I rose up. Right? I, Devorah, rose up. Shakamti Aim Be Israel, a woman in Israel, a mother in Israel. Now was when we were free. It was because of me. That's number one. Number two, go back to chapter 4, sentence 9. I thought about skipping this because we're going to come back to it soon in the text itself. Nonetheless, the story is that she's going to tell Barak to go to war. And Barak is going to say, I'm not going unless you come with me. And look what she says to him in sentence 9. She says, I'm going to go with you, but you should know your glory will not come because of what you do on this path, because Sisera is going to be given to a woman instead. So you see two things here. Number one, you see this level of arrogance, I think is the word, but also the emphasis on gender. You know, Ein Bi Yisrael, in the fifth chapter, she emphasizes that I, a mother in Israel, and here, your glory isn't going to come because Sisera is going to be given to a woman. You know, there's this emphasis on that aspect of her. Now,
had Barak gone, it wouldn't have been given to a woman. Barak didn't get off his bum.
Maybe. There's more to say about that. We're not done with that.
Why would he ask a woman to come with him to war?
Good. We'll come back to that. We're not there yet. It's a good question. The immediate point here is the discomfort with the arrogance. And yes, there's, without a doubt, the whole issue of her being a woman is playing into this. I mean, that's all feeds into this also. That's a whole other way to look at this story. So that's exactly where I wanted to go. Linda says, you know, if she was a man, would she be criticized in this way? And the answer is yes. And that's why I wanted to make sure to get to this. Look at your sheet, please. Source number 8. For the Gemara in the beginning of Brachos. The Gemara there tells a very difficult story regarding King Chizkiah. King Chizkiah is one of our good, really good kings. We have, in the history of the Jewish people, very few kings about whom we can say, unreservedly, this was a good one. Right? When you start counting them out, you realize just how few we had. David, Shlomo sometimes, Chizkiyahu, Yoshiyahu. It's a very short list. You know, we liked Shaul also until everything else happens. I said David first.
I know. Why?
Why? He's fantastic.
But he wasn't such a perfect king.
Who asked for perfection?
He did a few bad things he shouldn't have done.
I'm going to leave that as something for another time, because otherwise we're never going to see this book again. So one day we have to discuss whether we're going to see Shmuel. Yeah. So the one of the stories involving Chizkiyahu is that Yeshayah, he gets very sick, and he appears to be dying. And Yeshayah, the Navi, is sent to him with a message that he's going to die. He should instruct his household because he's going to die. And then Chizkiyah davens, and he survives. There's a whole backstory on it in the Gemara about how Chizkiyahu had been told by somebody that he was going to have a child who was going to be horribly wicked, and therefore he doesn't get married, and he doesn't want to have any kids. And that the message from Yeshayah is, that's not your business. You are supposed to do what you're supposed to do, and let God worry about what's coming next. And so he indeed does have children, and his son, it turns out to be Menashe, who spends 22 years corrupting the Jewish people and leading them astray before he does tshuva. For 33 years he tries to bring them back. The bottom line is that, as the Gemara reads it, Chizkiyahu has made a big mistake by trying to take control of the future and trying to avoid God's plan. But look at number 8 now. Chizkiyahu Amar, Leisa Yeshayahu Gaboi. Chizkiyah said, I'm not going to Yeshayah. Chizkiyah is ill. Something is wrong. He refuses to go to Yeshayah. He says, Yeshayah should come to me. I'm the king. Dehachi Ashichan Be'Eliyahu. We see that with Eliyahu. Da'azal Agabe Achav. Eliyahu went to King Achav. Achav was a terrible human being. The king of Yisrael, well, all the prophets of Avodah Zarah, his wife was Izebel, this whole story with Achav. Eliyahu went to Achav. Eliyahu was a prophet. Achav was a bad king. Certainly Yeshayah should come to me. Yeshayahu Amar, Leisei Chizkiyahu Gaboi. Yeshayah says, Chizkiyahu should come to me. Da'achi Ashkechan B'Yehoram Ben Achav, Da'azal Agabe Elisha. Because King Yehoram, son of Achav, went to Elisha. Elisha being the Navi after Eliyahu. So each of them says the other one should come to me. The Gemara is being critical. The Gemara is not happy about this. Well, the Gemara is not saying that. The Gemara is saying he didn't go because he should come to me. So my point to Linda, and I it isn't to use personally because I knew this question was going to come up. That's why I brought it on the source sheet. Is that it's not that she's being singled out. She's a woman. How dare she, you know, demand that Barak come to her? Anybody in this position who makes such a demand is already looked at askance. Having said that, she makes the point about being a woman, and the Gemara does, this full Gemara, I didn't bring you the whole thing in number 7, but the Gemara does take up the fact that, aside from this being arrogant, she makes a point about the fact that she is that she is a woman. Okay, the discomfort shows up in one other place in the Gemara. If you take a look at number 9, the Gemara there talks about what happens if somebody is arrogant. And it says, Im chacham hu, if someone is a sage, but he is arrogant, chachmasa mistalekes mimenu. He loses his wisdom, and they actually talk about this happening with Hillel. Even though Hillel is the one you would think of as never arrogant, right? He's the most humble and so on. There's one particular story in which he displayed something that appeared to be arrogance, and that's the story that I skipped here in the ellipsis. But then it says, Im navihu, if he is a prophet, nivuasa mistalekes mimenu. His prophecy leaves him. How do you know that? Mi devora, because it happened with devora. Dichsiv, as the pasuk says, Chadlu prazon bi Israel, chadelu ba shakamti devora shakamti aim bi Israel. That's the pasuk we looked at from the fifth chapter, right, where she took credit for restoring the Jewish people. And then a few sentences later, it's going to say, Uri, Uri, devora, wake up, devora. She's saying that herself. Uri Uri Dabri Shir, wake up and speak the poem. And what this is suggesting is, when she says that, she's saying, wait, I forgot, my powers of prophecy have left me. I'm suddenly stuck mid-prophecy, and I can't remember what I was going to say because of what she had said a few psukim earlier. That's what the Gemara is picking up on. But what I'm bringing this here, not so much to address Parak Hei yet, because we're not there yet, as to show you the Gemara has problems with this vision of Devorah. It doesn't square with what we'd like to see when we talk about someone who is pious and righteous, wife of Lapidot. That whole image on the one side doesn't square well with somebody who's going to say, I'm the one, I saved everybody, who's going to rebuke Barak the way that she does. So what picture do we now have of Devorah, having seen all of these different ways to explain her? Like, it's not simple and straightforward, but what do you see now when you think of Devorah? Yeah.
Strong woman.
Right, or what you were saying?
Tough cookies.
Definitely tough. Independent. You know, very possibly single. We still don't know exactly, but certainly we have the views that say she separated from her husband because she was in the Viyah. There's a level of discomfort with the way that the fire, you know, literal or otherwise, is expressed. Whether fire is lapidot or not, there's fire there.
But she's also human, like all the other leaders. They've all done something.
Oh yeah.
That's not 100%.
Right. Not to mention she's victim to the fact that the Navi discusses her. Meaning, I know nothing about Shamgar ben Anat. Right. He killed some people with a cattle goad. That's what I got. Cool. So I don't know his flaws either. I know nothing. Anybody who gets described with any length in Tanakh ends up showing flaws. There is nobody in Tanakh who, you know, you get a real description of who doesn't do something wrong or betray some kind of a weakness. At least that I can think of.
Yosef.
No weaknesses in Yosef? Oh, brothers, I had this great dream, by the way. Yeah, it involved you bowing to me. This is a problem. I think I said it once before this year. The Gemara in Shabbos says that there are four people who never sinned. And they're all the people who are in the background. The people you know nothing about. Binyamin, brother of Yosef. Amram, father of Moshe, Kilav, son of David, and Yishai, father of David, right? That's your list of four people who are named, and we know nothing about them. That's it.
But that's why they can say that.
But that's the thing. It takes being in the background, perhaps, also. That's a piece of it. Yeah. Okay. Good. And that's the excuse for all the rest of us.
They don't live in the past.
There aren't women on the list of four. It's because all of them never sin. That's why.
No.
Did you turn it off? No. Oh, okay. If you did, you should turn it back off.
I can't. I know who's listening now. He wants to hear the shiur. Okay. So, that brings us to Pasuk Vav. Let's talk about what happens. This plan of Devorah and Barak, which we now already know she summons him. She sent and she summoned Barak, son of Avinoam, from Kedesh Naphtali. Kedesh is a city in its own right. It's not Kedesh Naphtali as one name. It's Kedesh, which is in Naphtali, because there are several places in Israel that are known as Kedesh, Kadesh, and so on. So this is Kedesh that's in Naphtali.
Do we know who Avinoam was?
Father of Barak. That's what we got.
That's all we know.
That's as far as I can recall, yeah. Vatomer Elav. And she said to him, Halo Tziva Hashem Elokei Yisrael. How do they translate the word hello in your translation?
Behold.
Behold? Okay. Hath not. I like hath not. Hath not is, I think, a more literal translation of hello. Right? Hasn't the God of Israel commanded, Lechu Mashachta Bahar Tabor, you should go draw upon, persuade, Mount Tabor. V'lakachta imcha aseres alafim ish mibnei Naphtali u'mibnei Zebulun. Bring with you 10,000 men from Naphtali and Zebulun. Right? If you can picture the map, those who were here when we did Yoshua, Naphtali is in the north, next to Asher. Right? Zebulun is below them, with this sort of lateral line, and then a possibility of either jumping up north on the coast, or somehow they have something on the coastline as well, because we know they have to have some coast. They have the boats and so forth, right? So Naphtali and Zebulun, take 10,000 of them. Not apparently from other tribes. We have to talk about that. Umashachti elecha el nachal kishon et sisra sar tzva yavin ve'as vichpo ve'as hamono unesatihu biyadecha. And the Nevuah, the prophecy, says, I am going to draw towards you. You're going to draw from Har Tavor. I'm going to draw towards you to Nachal Kishon. Sisera, the general of Yavin, along with his chariots, along with his masses, unesatihu biyadecha, and I'm going to give him into your hands. That is the message, excuse me, to Barak. To which Barak responds in Pasuk Ches, Vayomer Eleha Barak, Barak said to her, Im telchi imi v'halachti, if you go with me, I'll go. V'im lo selchi imi, but if you're not going with me, lo elech, I'm not going. Now, we don't actually know what Barak's job description is. Right? Meaning, we've been assuming people called him here, people called him general. It didn't say that. Right? It just said, Barak ben Avinoam of Kedesh Naphtali, which may support the idea that he's actually her husband, in the sense that, why else did she pick him? Like, we don't know anything about him. So, maybe that lends itself to the husband explanation. It's a thought, anyway. But in terms of...
it also makes it less that she's less arrogant.
Why isn't that arrogant?
Because she wanted to...
If she says, well, I want my husband to be the one, and I'm going to push him into being...
Oh, you see, that's arrogant. Okay.
I would...
Not her own arrogance. But I think, yeah. Like, she doesn't mind sharing the glory with her husband, like, you know, letting her husband...
Right. Yeah, there's a level in that. The discomfort is something we're going to have to talk about, why he doesn't want to go, but I think really the first question is why him in the first place. And we're not going to get, as far as I can tell, a good answer. But look what she says back to him in Pasuk Tes. But Tomer, she said, Haloch eleich imach, I'm going to go with you. Efes, but, ki lo siya tibar techal haderech asher ata alech, your glory is not going to come on the route that you're traveling. Ki biyadi shayim kor Hashem es Sisera, as we had before, God will sell Sisera, give Sisera into the hands of a woman. And then she got up and she went to Kedesh, she went to Kedesh with Barak. So she summoned him to her, and then they're going to go back to Kedesh. Okay. So there's a lot that we have to understand here about what exactly it is that's going on. But in order to really get it, you have to jump to the fifth parak, Pasuk Yudalit, chapter 5, sentence 14.
She's going anyway.
So take a look at Psukim Yudalet Yerchet 14-18, which say, Mini Ephraim, she's talking about who comes with them or doesn't come with them to battle. So, Mini Ephraim Sharsham Ba'amalek. She says, from Ephraim, their route is in Amalek. That's their land. Acharecha Binyamin ba'amamecha. After you, Binyamin, with your hosts, with all of your troops. Mini Machir Yardu Machogikim, from Machir, Machir east of the Yarden, that's Menashe. From him, the officers descended. Umi Zibulun Moshchim Beshevet Sofer, and from Zibulun as well, those who write with the pen. We have to explain this more when we see it, when we see the actual perek. Visarai bi Sahar im Devora, and officers, Sarim, right, with Yisachar, with Devora, they were also in the war. So in other words, it's not just Zebulun and Naphtali. You have these, not all. We have they joined too. V'Yisachar, Cain, Barak, Ba'emek, Shulach, Baraglav. Biflagos Reuven, Gdolim, Chikike, Lev. And you also had Reuven involved, the tents of Reuven. They're part of this as well. And then, Lama Yashavta Bein HaMishpesayim Lishmo Shrikos Adarim Leflagos Reuven Gedolim Chikrei Lev. She starts to talk about those who did not show up, the tribes who are not there. Yeah, I'm realizing now I'm going to get myself into trouble about who went and who didn't go, because this really requires better explanation. But one that I wanted to show you here is Asher in Pasuk Yud Zayin. Naphtali is going, Asher is not going. They're side by side. One goes, one doesn't go. This speaks to the tribalism that develops. They stop seeing themselves as a full nation. And that's what I wanted to highlight. Okay. Question is, who did she ask and who didn't she ask? Abarbanel seems to think that all of them were summoned and only some went. But what we read so far sounds like she only summoned Zebulun and Naphtali. She said 10,000 from Zebulun and Naphtali, that's all you're supposed to bring. Okay. The opening word in her message to Barak, the word halo, which we translated as hath not. What's the problem with that word?
He doesn't know. Isn't that more of a...
Yeah. Right? What do you do with this word? How did this yeah. In other words, normally when you start a conversation with somebody, especially one in which you want to persuade someone of something, you start out with some kind of introduction. You could have said Tziva Hashem Elokei Yisrael, right? God has instructed. You could restructure the sentence Elokei Yisrael Tziva, Hello is not the way that you start. Hello is not hello. You don't start with it. Just, it doesn't make any sense.
It's as if it's sort of continuing a conversation that they've had
before.
Yeah.
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 Right. It's a very odd thing. So the commentators take it in a few different ways. Rashi says she's saying it because it's an extension of the old command of conquering Canaan. Hasn't God already said you're supposed to conquer Canaan? No. That's Rashi's take. Others retranslate the word halo. So Mitzudat David says the word halo means this is prophecy coming. It's an introductory word. Ralbag says halo means in truth. In truth, God has commanded and so forth. Dat Mikra says halo is a word of encouragement. He's pushing him a little bit. But I like what Radak does. It's not terribly deep, but I think it has ramifications for the way we read Tanakh in general. You take a look at Radak, source number 11. He says, Eino tchilas hadvarim. This isn't the first thing that she says to him. Ela amra lo dvarim acherim kodim lozat. Sorry. She already had said other things to him. The pasuk only brings us that which you need to know from this. Hello, here's the digest. But we didn't get the rest of the conversation. And it gives us another example from Rus. V'chein halo shama'at biti. Right? Where Barak says to her, Boaz says to her, you haven't you heard daughter, you know, go glean among them and so forth. Nothing's been said before this. So the answer is, it's only giving you a piece of the conversation. It's not giving you the full conversation. And the reason why I find that significant, and I emphasize it, is because, generally speaking, when we read these conversations, we assume that we're getting everything that was said back and forth. You know, sometimes we even have drushas. We have ideas that emerge from it. Well, why did they say this? Why didn't they say that? You know, the answer may well be, as Radhak is saying here, that you're not getting the full conversation. So I think that's an important thing to recognize. So she says, hello, you're supposed to go ahead and do this. And Barak does not say, you've had me at hello. The Ralbag asks a question. He says, if God is able to draw Sisera to this, you know, to this mountain, why doesn't God just draw the 10,000 also? Right. So Ralbag uses that for his overall philosophy. For those who remember from Yehoshua, when Ralbag talks about the way miracles work and the principle of trying to minimize miracles, they aren't just, you know, out there and happening whenever, but God does them when He needs to. So here He needs to use a miracle to bring Sisera, because He can't just appear to Sisera and say, you know, show up to fight the Jews. However, for us, He's not going to rely on a miracle to just, you know, persuade everybody that they all want to go to this one place. He's going to say, no, this is your job. Go out and summon 10,000 people.
He said about, like, when we show something, then He shows, like, going into the sea.
Yeah.
And then He says that we have to show our effort. So if they go, then He will make Sisera appear.
Right. And I think that's a reasonable take on this. Ralbag likes to make the point about miracles. That's his thing. But yes, I think that's also a reasonable explanation is, you know, you got to do something also. Okay. So Barak says no. He says, only if you go with me. Ralbag says it's because he wants her merit. He says, I don't think I'm worthy on my own, but Devorah, that works. Barbanel says there's something more here. He doesn't actually want her in battle. He wants her merit, or he wants her pull. Meaning, who am I, Barak? And that's actually a good question, because we don't know who he is. He says, if I tell them to go, I'm not going to get anywhere. But if Devorah tells them to go, now they're going to listen. So take a look at number 12.
He brought with them the Aron or whatever. It was kind of their religious, being on the battlefield. So she maybe is being that role.
He has an actual Aron. Although it tends to be a bad idea to bring it. Right? They try that later and it doesn't work out well. But
it's like bringing your sitter.
Could be, I suppose. Take a look at what Barbanel says. Lo amar zeh kimesapek benevuah sha'amra lo. He didn't say it as somebody who was doubting the validity of the prophecy. V'gam ka'ovral divrei ha'navi. He's also not violating the words of the Navi. Aval afi shehu Yisrael az yireyem upochtim mechel Sisera u'meiruchavav u'merkavav nebi u'mehamono. But since the Jews are afraid of Sisera, they're afraid of his army, his chariots, and so forth. Ra Barak ki aval pishu yikral ebnei Zevulun v'lebnei Naphtali l'milchama lo yelchu imo v'lo yaminu b'dvarav. He said, you know what's going to happen? I can summon them all I want. They ain't coming. They're going to think that they're getting into some kind of risky endeavor here. So he said to Devorah, I'm going to go if you go. That way they would see that the Neviah was the one who had commanded this and she's there. And then they'll believe it's from God. It wasn't, his invention. But rather, it's from God. Which is why we're going to see she's not actually going to go to war. She's going to stay on the mountain. So that supports the idea that the point is not to have her in the battle. The point is, whether you want to say, as Ora is suggesting, it's the religious totem, like the Aram, that they'll have with them, or whether you view it as to persuade people or her merits overall, inspiration, that's what he's looking for. And Devorah says, okay, but then there's no glory for you, because Sisera is going to be given into the hands of a woman. So Mitzudat David gives what I thought was a very good explanation here, and I brought it in number 13. He says, "Ha'pe'er hanitan l'saratzava, hu ba'avur echad mishnei drachim." He says, a military officer gets glory from one of two things. Either by showing his courage, he goes to war and he's not afraid. Or when he or one of his warriors kills the great warrior on the other side. Right? Either you have to have a feat of bravery, or you have to have a feat of accomplishment. And that's why she said, "Hello, Sisra, you must like the Isha. Vihiya Elisha's cover Akeni." And this goes back to the point that Linda or Diana had said before. He's actually, Sisra's going to be dead at Yael's hand regardless. It doesn't make a difference. That was already foretold. Sisra's going to die at the hands of Yael. However, V'imken, if so, what do you have left for your glory? Only the fact that you were brave. If you're afraid to go to war without me, then you're not going to get the glory that should come with being a general at all. Because there'll be nothing to praise you for. You're not brave, and you're not victorious. So what are you? That's essentially what she says to him. I like that read. I think that's a very sharp read. Although Barbanel does something interesting here. He notes that she still went along with it. You know, if a leader asks you, you may disagree. You can voice your disagreement, but fundamentally, you go along with it. Well, he doesn't need to respond. He got his way. In the end, she's going, so he's good. I imagine there may have been a conversation all the way back to Kedesh Naphtali. Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Ultimately, Vatelechem Barak Kecha, she went with him, so they had a nice long conversation on the way home. So, you know, she pushes Barak, she insults Barak, but ultimately she goes. So what I'll have to do next time is then see the actual battle and then what happens with Yael and Sisera.